We're on the road. Where transportation goes, community grows. Welcome to On the Road with the MTA. And welcome to another exciting edition of On the Road with the MTA. I am Jay Gibbons alongside with Stephanie Kay from the MTA. How you doing?
That's right. And have a good day. Yeah. You know, it's hard to believe, not just another new day, but Jay, it's a whole new year. Isn't that incredible how fast this year went? But sometimes it feels like it went a lot slower.
Yes, thank goodness 2020 can go away now. Let's start 2021.
Absolutely. But you know, in the upcoming year, we have all these resolutions that we're putting together, but we also have to think about our own security. What do we do when it comes to like maybe a will? A lot of people so unfortunately died unexpectedly. What do you do if you have a home, if you have a family, if you have somebody who passed away, maybe a parent? And these issues are happening more and more. And so I'm going to hold somebody who'd be the expert in this area. And I was able to. His name is Bob Manor. He's with Manor Law Group. It's a nationally recognized and respected elder law and estate planning firm with locations both in Grand Blanc and Rochester, Michigan. They help families with wills, trusts, critical legal planning for Michigan families, and all three of their attorneys are accredited by the Veterans Administration to assist veterans with claims and appeals. Now, attorney Bob Manor, who's going to be with us today, is nationally board certified as an elder law attorney by the National Elder Law Foundation, and he's one of only 19 attorneys in Michigan to achieve this acknowledgement. Now, Bob is also a leader among elder law attorneys in Michigan, and he is currently chair-elect of the State Bar of Michigan Elder Law and Disability Rights Section and past president of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, the Michigan chapter. Now, they've also been voted the best or favorite law firm by members of their community right here for the last 8 years in a row. That's pretty impressive. So I am so happy to announce and welcome today Bob Manor. Thank you for joining us, Bob.
Well, thank you, Stephanie and Jay, and thanks for having me on the podcast today.
Well, you know, a lot of us have always thought, you hear about having wills or a trust or estate planning, and a lot of us think, I don't have estates to plan. I don't have that kind of money. I don't know what I'm doing. But if you even have a home, it's really important to make sure it goes to the right people without going through probate and how to keep things in order. And I know that you really do a good job with resources to help pay for, like, say, long-term care or planning for what happens after retirement. And estate planning, like the wills and trusts and power of attorney, healthcare advocates. So help us along the way to tell us, what can we do right now as the year is approaching here? It's a whole new year. What should people be doing? What should we have in place? Is a will enough, or do we even need it? Can you tell us, direct us what to do?
Excellent question, Stephanie. And so one of the things that I like to point out and try to change the focus a little bit, because most people expect to go to an attorney to talk about what happens when they die, right? And
sure.
So what I like to talk about a little bit more than some folks is what happens if you don't die. And what I mean is, what about the rest of your life? You know, we got to make sure we've got things in place for the rest of your life. And so, yes, we should talk about the will and other alternatives to the will to make sure that you have that it's all set for your family, and that we've got a plan in place for that that's going to go smoothly and not cost a lot of money and all of that. But
sure.
What happens between now and then? And making sure that if you got sick, that you have somebody to be able to make healthcare decisions for you, which isn't automatic anymore. People just assume that family can make those decisions. That's not automatic. Hospitals want something in writing. They want a legal document. That we've waived any privacy restrictions so that our family wouldn't be able to get access to the information they need to make decisions. And if appropriate, appoint somebody to be able to make financial decisions for us if we're ever in a position where we can't do that ourselves. So to me, the lifetime documents are even more important than what happens after death. They're both very important, but the lifetime documents are extremely important, both from the standpoint of making sure that things go the way that you want them to and you have the right people in charge, but also that you're not leaving your family a big mess in case you get in a car accident or have a stroke or have some other illness or dementia or something like that, and the family's scrambling to be able to make the decisions or have the authority to make decisions.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I was watching Susan Orman, and I've had a chance to speak with her in person, and she's been very dynamic and interesting and informative. But she mentioned how important it is to have a living, revocable trust. She said that is what puts the things in place that you're mentioning. If you were to be in a car accident or maybe have a stroke, which my father had a stroke, and you needed to have somebody in place who will pay your bills while you are disabled yourself to be able to do that. So is that what you're talking about? Is the living, revocable trust? Would you recommend one of those?
Not to everybody. I know that Susie Orman does tend to really promote the trust, and I am a big fan of trust for lots of folks, for most folks that have a reasonable amount of assets. You don't have to be rich in order to have a trust. Sometimes that's a misconception that people have is, well, I don't need a trust because I'm not rich. Well, if you have a house, if you have some savings or investments, a trust can often be a really good choice. And there's particular family situations where a trust can be a really good choice, such as if it's a second marriage or a blended family, or, if we have any kind of complicated situation where we're not just dividing everything equally between the kids. And so the advantage of the trust, and so let's define that. What do we mean by a trust? So I like to talk about it and use the analogy. So this isn't a perfect example, but it's a nice analogy to look at the trust like a contract between you and your family. That's really all it is. It's a written contract that says, here's how I want things to go when I'm alive and well, if I get sick, and after I die. And here's how I want my assets to be managed when I'm alive and well, if I get sick, and after I die. And so what would be the rule when you're alive and well? And the rule in the trust typically is, you get to do whatever you darn well please. You have no restrictions on what you can do when you're alive and well. But then it gives some instructions for what happens if you get sick and what happens when you die.
So is a trust different than a will? Is it less expensive or more expensive?
Typically it's, well, good question. So how lawyers, they always get accused of parsing words. So it's more expensive in the short run, but less expensive in the long run. Here's what I mean by that. It is typically more expensive to set up a trust now. So if you go to a lawyer and ask to set up a trust, they would likely quote you a price to do a will-based plan and a separate price to do a trust-based plan. And the trust-based plan is typically going to be more expensive. However, in the long run, it's going to cost your family typically a lot more to go through probate with a will, because a will actually does require probate to be effective. The will isn't self-fulfilling. It's not self-actualized, so to speak. You can't take the will to the bank and say, well, I need to access my mom's bank account. She's passed away. Here's her will. She appointed me as the executor. Can I access the bank account? They're going to say, well, where's your court order? Same thing with the house. If mom had a house and she passes away and she leaves you the house in the will, and you go to the realtor with the will and say, well, I'm the executor. Mom said I get the house. It says so right here in the will. She'll say, okay, well, where's your court order? Because we can't sell that house. We can't do anything at that house or transfer it to you until you get a court order that says so. And that's what the decedent's estate through probate is.
Well, I know my mom has something called a ladybird, and there's three of us in the family, three children. So she has our names on the ladybird. It's her home 100% until she passes away. And then it's supposed to go right into our names without going through probate. Is that correct?
That is accurate. So that's an excellent, that's a great synopsis. You said it exactly right. She still owns it. She has all rights to it. She can even change her mind and take you off of it if she wants to. And that's the whole point of it, is that she's reserving when you do it. And it's just kind of nicknamed a ladybird deed. And there's a long story as to why it's called that. But the bottom line is, with the ladybird deed, it says that she still has the right to sell it. She still has the right to mortgage it. She could sign a new ladybird deed that says that it goes to somebody else. She has basically all of the rights to it. But if she hasn't done any of those things, then it would transfer to the three people after her death. However, this is where, again, we got to think through all the consequences of that. And that's where I'm not a huge fan of using ladybird deeds for real estate when it comes to transferring it to multiple family members. If it was a house that was worth $25,000 and it's going to one child, then maybe I would say, yeah, that's, you know, it just doesn't justify the cost of additional planning to do to not do a ladybird deed. The issue with a ladybird deed as it goes to more than one child or that has a more substantial value, there's a number of issues, but the first and primary one is, God forbid, and my job is to think about bad things happening, but God forbid, what if people die in the wrong order? What if one of the three kids dies before mom dies? Well, now we have a real issue because it is not clear, and there's actually been a debate among attorneys as to what would happen there and what a title company is willing to do with that if the deed says, upon my death, it goes to my three children, but one of the three children has already passed away before mom. I believe that there's a pretty good chance that that one-third portion of the house will still end up going through probate because the title company is going to need clarification as to what happens to that one-third, regardless of how the will, the ladybird deed is written. So that's one example of it. The second example, and most people don't think this is a big deal, but I can tell you after practicing 25 years that it is a big deal. And that is, I'm sure you love your siblings, and I'm sure you guys get along really well. And I, you know, I'm not trying to pick on you, Stephanie, but I can tell you after 25 years, putting three siblings on a deed together many, many, many times is going to result in some conflict, some disagreements, some arguments, some family fights that last for the rest of their lives. And, you know, I recall one case I had where the family all said they got along. They were all coming in practically holding hands. And then we got to sell them the house and they couldn't agree on the realtor. And we had a dozen calls back and forth trying to moderate who was going to be the realtor. Then they finally picked a realtor, and then they got multiple offers, and they couldn't agree on which offer they were going to take. Oh, and no. It was just went on and on and on. And I can tell you to this day, those siblings are not talking to each other. They got their money, but it created this big family.
Yeah,
fight. Go ahead.
You get a big family like that, I'm sure you're going to run into a lot of conflicts. Is it? And I bet you that's probably more than just financial, right?
Right. And, you know, a lot of times it is over, you know, other things that have happened in history. There might be some, you know, latent disagreement that happened 20 years ago that is actually now coming out after mom passes or things like that. I'm not saying that's going to happen in your family, Stephanie, but what I am saying is it is a cautionary note. Sure. And if there is more thorough planning, here's what I mean by thorough planning. So if you think about a trust as being a contract, you can put all the details in there. You cannot, a ladybird deed is typically one or two pages long. It has no details. It has no nuance to it. And so we're counting on that deed to still make sense maybe 20 years from now, maybe 30 years from now, maybe after other people have died in the wrong order, maybe after the property has changed values. You know, there's a variety of things that could happen between now and then. Maybe after mom needed some kind of long-term care and we needed to, you know, deal with that issue from the standpoint of getting nursing home care or in-home care or things like that. And the idea is a trust will often go into a lot more details to say, well, we will decide what happens in the event that one of the siblings dies before mom does. We're going to decide what happens, and it can put in all those details, all that nuance, and make it for a smoother transfer after death because we put one person in charge. I always use a couple of examples. You know, you usually want one cook in the kitchen. You want one quarterback on the field of the football game. You don't want, you know, multiple people in charge because it often will create, you know, delays and conflict.
So there's no simple answer, right? I mean, just at the, it depends on what your family situations are, but what's the best thing to do? I mean, what's one of the best things you'd recommend to do? The trust?
Well, yeah, so I want to go back just for a second there because you mentioned the trust. And so the lifetime documents, definitely the trust is a lifetime document. But not everybody needs a trust. That's going to be a case-by-case situation. And I really do think, you know, people often they want to decide this for themselves. They want sort of one magic pill that's going to solve everybody's problems, and that's just not realistic for this type of a thing. This is, you know, everybody's life is going to be a little bit different. So somebody that has a house and a bank account might have a different plan than somebody that has a 401k and a house and a cabin up north. You know, they're going to be different circumstances. And that's what we're here for. That's what lawyers are here for, to basically look at your situation and make recommendations based on your specific needs. And one size does not fit all. But there is a couple of things. So having just said that one size doesn't fit all, there's a couple of things that everybody should consider having. And the trust isn't one of them. A lot of people would be well off with the trust. A lot of people, a trust would be a great answer. I do think it's a better answer than the Ladybird deed in most cases, or at least in many cases. But there's a couple of documents that really everybody should think about having. Now, it has to be, I always say this, and it's going to sound kind of funny, that you need somebody that you love and you trust. And if you don't have anybody that you love or trust, or love and trust, then maybe these documents aren't for you. But if you have people that you love and trust, then you should probably have a healthcare directive. And so that's somebody who's going to be able to convey your wishes for you in the event that you are unable to do so, either because you're physically unable to, or because you are have some kind of memory loss or reason why you can't understand what's going on. And so typically in these documents, in order for it to become effective, two doctors have to determine that you're not capable of making the decision yourself. Because you should always make your own healthcare decisions, right? You can get advice from people, but if you're alive and well, you should always be able to make your own healthcare decisions. When people sign these documents, they'll often joke, oh, you know, my spouse will just pull the plug if I get a cold. Well, no, they won't, because they can't. It's always going to be that you get to make that decision yourself unless you two doctors have determined that you can't.
Well, my mom has me down as her medical advocate, so that's the same thing, right?
Exactly. So medical advocate, the attorneys use lots of different words to say basically the same thing. Medical advocate, patient advocate, healthcare directive, healthcare power of attorney. There are some people that even call it a living will, which I don't really like that name because it's confusing. It sounds like your last will and testament, but the living will is actually a healthcare document. And then the other one that just about everybody should have, if you have somebody that you love and trust, is a healthcare privacy waiver, or a HIPAA waiver. If you've probably heard of the HIPAA law from about 15 years ago, or actually probably even longer ago now. But the HIPAA law is where they passed all these privacy laws saying they're not supposed to share any information that could be even slightly related to medical information with anybody, even your spouse or even your kids. And so when you go to the doctor, you sign a HIPAA waiver. You've probably signed them multiple times whenever you went to a new doctor or a new hospital, anything like that, new dentist. But I like you to have one that isn't specific to a doctor, because if you ever get in a situation where you can't sign a HIPAA waiver, you'll still want those people that you love and trust to be able to be in the room with you when the doctor talks to you, be able to ask questions, things like that. So that's a really, really important document, and it's a very simple document. It doesn't cost a lot. It's a very simple document, and almost everybody should have that if you have somebody that you would want to be in the room with you when the doctor's talking to you.
And that's called a healthcare privacy?
Yep. Typically, we call it the HIPAA waiver, H-I-P-A-A waiver.
Okay.
The health insurance, I don't remember the rest of it.
Yeah.
Health insurance, privacy, and I don't remember the rest of it.
It just means your loved one can come in the room with you and hear what the doctor is saying without any problems.
That's right. Get copies of documents, be able to ask questions, get a status report from the doctor, things like that.
So if you had the first thing, that's just not going to automatically do it, right? If you are the, whatever you call it, the healthcare directive or the power of attorney for medical, that won't do it?
Well, and here's why. Because the healthcare directive doesn't take effect until two doctors have declared you to be incompetent. Well, you might be competent, but still unable to, you know, sign a HIPAA waiver, or just from a timing standpoint, we might not need to activate the healthcare directive, which requires two doctors to certify you're not able to make your own decisions, but you'd still want people to be able to be in the room with you or ask questions or those types of things.
Sure.
So we actually want it as a separate document that is effective immediately, saying these people that I've listed can have access to my information.
Good to know. Thank you. Is there another one besides those two?
So, and then the third one is a little bit more dicey to the extent that it involves money, right? And so the reason I say it's dicey, and even the Michigan Attorney General's office has been concerned about this, and the prosecutors have been concerned about this, because sometimes people use these documents to take advantage of older folks.
Yes.
And that's the financial power of attorney. Now, we got to walk this fine line here with the financial power of attorney, because we don't want, certainly we wouldn't want to give it to anybody that we even have the slightest hint that they might ever take advantage of us, or, you know, borrow money from us without telling us, or, you
right.
know, anything where they're not very good with their own finances. So you got to be careful about who you give it to. But it's such an important document if you do have those people that you trust, that you think are sufficiently financially sound, that they wouldn't get confused by, you know, commingling your money and their money, which you'd never want to do, and appointing somebody who would be able to pay your bills for you if you couldn't. It's a really important thing. And so you can do that through the trust, but you can also do it through a financial power of attorney, or sometimes referred to as a durable power of attorney.
Well, if somebody had absolutely no money whatsoever and they could not get these records, but they really wanted to get the help, would it be enough if they just went to all the banks? Like, just say, I'll use my mom's example. She put my name on all of her bank accounts. So
sure.
I am already on her accounts, and she knows she can trust me because I don't take money out, but I help.
Right.
I can help pay her bills. Is that sufficient enough if somebody doesn't have any other means of help?
Yeah. So publicly, I say no. Publicly, I say no. You parents should not put their kids' names on bank accounts. And I know the bank will tell you to do this. So you go to the credit union, you go to the bank, they'll often just say, just add your daughter's name to the account. Here's why I don't recommend it. And so, because if I tell somebody that they, I've had folks come in that say they have no money, and when we dig down, they have $500,000. And I have some people come in and they say they have no money, and they have no money. And
yeah.
So I never want to give a broad across the board advice to say it's okay to put kids' names on it. Although if there really is no money, then what's the risk, right?
So. Sure.
But I generally don't, consistently say, don't put your kids' names on the bank accounts, because what you're doing now, the child now owns the account 100%, just like the parent owns the account 100%. So if anything bad happens to the child, then your money is exposed, because the child got divorced, got in a lawsuit, got a medical expense, didn't pay their credit card bill, had their house foreclosed. I'll give you one quick example. This is one of the more extreme examples. Had a client that we were helping years ago. She was close to 80 years old, and she had been taking care of her husband for years. She was just this wonderful woman, and she had her husband was pretty much bedbound, couldn't do hardly anything for himself. And for 10 years, she had taken care of him every day, just taking care of him. She's getting to be almost 80 years old. She physically could not take care of him anymore. Well, we were able to help her find a place that could take care of him. And we were able to help her get Medicaid to pay for that and still protect her house and her income and her assets. There's ways to do that legally and still protect yourself and still protect the spouse. And so we did all of that. And we ask all the questions about, are you on anybody else's accounts and all that type of thing. But then we got a call partway through this process, and she was just, you know, Monday morning, she was calling. She was really worried. She said, you know, I thought about it and thought about it, and I didn't realize this at the time, but I think I'm on my mom's farm. And so, I'm sure we asked the question, but it kind of surprised me that when she was almost 80 that her mom was still living.
Wow.
Her mom was still living, over 100 years old, living on a farm in Alabama, which she had put her kids' names on that farm. And she had put her kids' names on her bank accounts and all of that. So unless we had done what we needed to do to protect those assets, 100-year-old moms or 104-year-old moms assets, her farm, her bank accounts, all of that would have been exposed to her daughter's husband's nursing home costs.
Oh.
That would have prevented him from getting Medicaid because those are assets of the daughter because her name's on the account.
Sure.
And so basically anything bad happening to the kid is now a financial burden of the parent. That's why I generally say do not put your kids' names on assets. If you really have nothing to lose, then it can't really hurt you any. But if you have assets, I would not put their names on it because then if something bad happens to the kid, that also happens to you.
Good point. I know my mom's always said if someone got in a car accident, they got sued, they'd come after her for her house. So she was aware of all of that. So you've been so helpful. I know people out there probably have a lot more questions because everybody's situation is different. And do you do free consultations? Can people call you with questions? How does that work?
Yeah, we do a lot of free consultations. It really depends on the nature of the legal issue that they call about. So okay. There's basically three areas of law that we practice. The one that we've talked about today, which is what we refer to as estate planning. That's your wills and trusts and powers of attorney and things like that. And we do completely free consultations on that. There's not a cost to come in to talk about those things. And then the two other areas of law that we practice in is estate administration. So somebody's died and now we got to make sure that the house gets retitled or the assets get set up properly. And that is not a free consultation because that's basically they need to take legal action. And so we're going to help them with that legal process. And then the final thing that typically is not a free consultation is they have a crisis. So we do what we call crisis planning. And the crisis, that's just what we call it. But the crisis is basically mom or dad or spouse, they need some form of long-term care, whether it be home care or nursing home care or assisted living, whatever it is. And we got to figure out how are we going to get that care? Where are we going to get that care? How are we going to get good care? And how are we going to pay for it?
Right.
And so there's a lot of programs out there, government programs that will help pay for that. And we help folks through that. And there is a consultation charge for that meeting.
Well, I do know you work with a lot of veterans and seniors, which we just love here at MTA. That's our main goal, is to helping people that are disabled or seniors or veterans or anyone in need. And I don't know if you realize this, maybe you do, but you can tell all your veteran friends there as well, that MTA does provide 6 free rides for veterans each month. And that's also their widows get that or their spouses. So that could be 12 per household if they need a ride to health and wellness, anything to, they need to go to the grocery store, they need to go to the doctor's appointments, they need to go to pharmacies. And right now, people can get a ride to your place to talk to you through your ride for as low as $2.
Wow.
So let your clients know that there's transportation for them and there's help that way as well. Through MTA.
Yeah, that's really great. That's really fantastic. That's good to hear.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to working with you more in the future. And I gotta thank you so much, Mr. Manor, because we really do appreciate all of your expertise. And that phone number they can call you, is that still 810-694-9000?
Yes.
All right. Any last minute words you'd like to give us?
We also have a toll-free number, which is 800-990-6030.
All right. Well, I thank you so much. And I hope you have a very safe and prosperous new year.
Thank you, Stephanie.
You bet. Thank you. And thank you so much for listening. And if you have any other questions, any other concerns, we'd love to hear from you. Just drop us a line at podcast.mtaflint.org. Wishing you a very healthy, safe, and prosperous new year.
You've been listening to On the Road with the MTA. For more information on our services and community outreach, visit us online anytime at www.mtaflint.org and be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. The MTA, your community, your connection, your way.